Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about New Scientist, 29th of September 2018. This is probably the third episode. I'm trying to make each episode push myself a bit over an hour and 10 minutes, as much as I can go. And I read the various articles. Now, for this is the Inca civilization, and look, the Inca civilization absolutely fascinates me, because although people really poo-poo it as not doing various things, our civilization also doesn't do various things. It also does. So the Incas were profoundly narrow. Well, I don't say this in judgment, but ostensibly, one of the words, scientific words you could say for the civilization, it was a narrow civilization. They would, as said a long time before, raise their kids in little pits, so they would have no contact for a certain time, and then come out shaped individuals. And a lot of the Inca wars were ritualistic, a lot of death was ritualistic. It wasn't as... I think there were sacrifice. It was interesting, human sacrifice coming along. But this idea that they achieved so much, but part of their civilization was this almost anesthetic, intellectual anesthetic, which meant that they couldn't achieve things as seen from the outside civilization. So outside Western civilization, we would say, well, they don't have, they have silver and gold, they didn't have iron, didn't have beasts of burden, didn't have writing, they didn't have a mathematics that we could understand, or a type of maths we could understand, yet they had a very highly functioning society. So because the society was highly functioned, they actually became very wed with a sort of ignorance. Now, I can't quite express this, but I have this sincere, and I don't mean this judgmentally, or it's not something that I feel that I want to admonish people about, but the way that they live their lives at the moment, in our civilization, I feel that there's this inability to think, communicate, extend, and go beyond or have time off. I mean, the overall thing is that we have achieved this civilization in which we don't have to work very hard all the time to make stuff, eat stuff. We can have a huge amount of time, and we tend to use that time as leisure or waste time. We watch sport, playing sport, or just bumming around. We don't seem to spend that time in a intellectual depth of work. And I feel our society, to me, I feel as though I'm living in the Inca civilization now. And I don't feel so I want to judge my civilization. I don't feel like so I want to judge the Inca civilization. But you get this real uncanny feeling that if when you're going back and looking at certain things, you know, what the heck is going on here? And you have these artifacts here which are just so intrinsically fascinating. So the Inca string writing, the way the story is told, and the framework of it, and the way that we do things. So we've got a civilization here so similar to it, but in a different way. We have such a limited civilization. Somehow I don't feel, you know what, I feel, I can't really judge it, but I don't feel there was this hate and politics and backstabbingness in the Inca civilization. There could have been, but I just don't feel they didn't innovate that. And I think we have innovated digital technology and all these technologies, but we've also innovated a form of fraudulent behaviour. I think a lot of our civilization is built on fake people, you know, really bad people in positions of power, and I just don't get that feeling from reading the Incas civilization. I feel they're very limited in civilizations, but for all the things they didn't invent this sort of metaculture that I see. So I see a culture and a metaculture, a culture within a culture, of things going forward. Hello, darling. Okay, so I'll read the article here on how to read Inca. So, did the Incas didn't have a written culture? But here it is. We thought they left no written records. Now we're untangling the truth. By Daniel Cosens. Now, of course, I don't think, they didn't have a symbolic culture which can be read like the Mayans. Of bitches and counting and stuff like that. And when they say untangle, they had a culture in which they did actually write on Inca strings, so I don't understand exactly what this person has said. Okay, now there's a small, little word here on the side of the page, and it doesn't really make sense. So someone's managed to stick their name in here, and it's called Johnny Wan. It's just written his thing up there. I don't know why he wanted his name written at the corner of a... It's written here on the page. I don't understand. Let me read for you the main text. The Incas left no doubt that theirs was a sophisticated, technologically savvy civilization. At its height in the 15th century, it was the largest empire in the Americas, extending 5,000 kilometers from early modern-day Ecuador to Chile. These were the people who built the Machu Picchu, a royal estate perched in the clouds, an extensive network of paved roads complete with suspension bridges crafted from woven grass. But the paradox of the Incas is, despite all the sophistication, they never learned to write. Well, you could say that, or they had, from a non-written civilization, they expanded great in one direction. Of course, we learn to write, but we also learn to lie through writing. Or did they? Yes, of course, the Incas may not have bequeathed any written workers, but they did have colourful knotted cords. Each of these devices, called a chipu, pronounced kipu, we know these intricate cords to be an abacus-like system of recording numbers. However, there has also been teasy hints that they may encode long-lost stories, myths and songs too. So we did know they did encode numbers because that was part of the huge socialist system of the Incas. The huge socialist system of the Incas, because they didn't have written records, you couldn't lie. I just thought this is something, a real profound feeling I have. In a century of study, no one has managed to make these Nox talks, no, this is not true, but it says, but recent breakthroughs have begun to unpick the tangled mysteries of the Andes, revealing the first signs of phonetic symbolism within the strands. Now, two anthropologists are closing in on the Inca equivalent of the Rosetta Stone. That is, so the Rosetta Stone was this stone written in Greek, Latin, and hieroglyphics. So it said the same event was described, and so they could actually understand what the different things are. And once they understood part of the code, they could fill in the story of the hieroglyphics. I think the French picked it up when they were down there with Napoleon, and they had his army. Napoleon went down there with an army of savants. It's very interesting, the idea that science legitimizes a civilization. Isn't that amazing? That I think the Israeli state now is saying this is why the Israelis are so high on science, that if they have science, well, how could they have atrocities? You can't have the two together. That would finally crack the code and transform our understanding of, well, would it? I don't think we have understood. We're not critical of our own civilization, so because we're not critical of ourselves, it's our view of the knots. I'll tell you what the knots are. It's a very beautiful thing to look at. So I wish I could describe the kipu here. It's a beautiful thing to observe. There seems to be a guard knot. Even just looking at it, it's a beautiful thing to watch, because it's got sort of an intensity, a radial intensity with it. So, like in normal writing, it's a grid line. This is almost a polar coordinate. So let's read it. A civilization whose history has so far been told only through the eyes of the Europeans who sought to eviscerate it. I think obliterate it. And this is the Spanish conquistadors led by Francisco Pizarro first encountered the Incas at the start of 1530s. They were awestruck by the magnificent stone cities, gold and treasure, but the Spanish began to take over the Inca Empire and impose their own customs. They become equally enthralled by the way the society was organized. I do remember this, that these two brothers felt really left off out by Cortez, having such a great time. So they went down looking for civilization. They found nothing. They didn't find the Incas at all, except they were going up a river. There's a river which goes up the Andes, and there was an Inca pleasure craft of these Incas having fun with a whole lot of gold goblets. And they were just there with all this gold, so it didn't matter. And they stopped them and said, hey, where's this? Tell us about the civilization. Of course, these people had no idea that these people just wanted to come in and conquer things. And it's also interesting how they used religion as well. But initially they missed everything until they just found this one raft with Incas on it, which also tells you that the Incas had pleasure rafts. You know, this is an interesting thing as you read through it. The Incas governed the 10 million people in their realm with what amounted to a federal system. Power was centered in Cusco in the south of what is now Peru, but spread through several levels of hierarchy across a series of partially self-governed provinces. It's interesting that they are self-governed because of the lack of communication. They had to have devolution of power, which is sort of strange. In the Romans, they got sophistication riding roads, then they had power corrupting, then they had to manually dissolve their power with Diocletian, who I thought was fantastic until I read more about Diocletian. This is a Roman emperor who was particularly gruesome. There was no money, no market economy. The production and distribution of food and commodities was centrally controlled. People had their own land to farm, but every subject was also issued with necessity from state storehouses in exchange for labour, enlisted through an impressive tribute system. So they were basically a communist society. And so what they didn't invent is that they've got a whole series of things that they did invent. So if they didn't invent things positive technology, they didn't invent other things, corruptions associated. You know, the corruption associated, obviously, with money, people streaming money, hoarding things, which they did. And if you write records, you can write a lie about yourself as much as anything else. And it's very interesting. It's intensely interesting to see current day records and how people lie and put them in and how they can't maneuver around them. Historians have argued variously that the Inca Empire was a socialist utopia or an authoritarian monarchy. Well, I think if you looked at how they worshipped their king, the monarchy, it wasn't authoritarian, it was a religious monarchy. So their king was provided everything they wanted until he became so fat he didn't have to walk anywhere. He came in a litter and was just provided as much sex as he wanted, I think. But no one disputes its efficiency. It was an extraordinary system, says Gary Urton, an anthropologist at Fabian University. Relatively speaking, it was sophisticated and seems to have worked well. That was my thing. This is my view, and I'm just a physicist looking at it. I don't think our system should be incredibly efficient. We've got computers, optical fibers, but the humans in the link are letting us down. Whereas here, they didn't have that, so the humans couldn't let them down. The key to success was the flow of reliable data in the form of censuses, tribute counts, storehouses, and inventories. For that, the Incas relied on Kip Pom Aqua, a series of keepers of quipus, a specially trained caste who could tie and read knots, also run and understand. Because if you wanted to communicate, you would run at high speed from point A to point B. Out of breath, you'd say the essential information, and the information would go across. Majority of Siren quipus consist of pencil-thick primary cord, from which hang multiple pendants cords, in turn subsidiaries. Spanish described how they were used to record all manners of information. The poet Casco de Vega, son of an Inca princess and a Spanish conquistador, noted in 1609 account that they had, quote, an admirable method of counting everything in the Inca's kingdom, including all taxes and tributes, both paid and due, which they did with knots in strings of different colours. Well, yeah, the information would have to flow up. You'd have to work out how much they required and go down. The other interesting thing is one thing that the Spanish didn't export to civilizations is women. Now, export women, it means that the men aren't going to create a half-caste society, an integration like it is there. So I find it an interesting thing. They didn't export women, but much later on. There are reasons to think quipus may record other things, including stories and myths, the sort of narrative information that many cultures write down. De la Vega was among many chroniclers who hinted as much, writing in one passage that the Incas recorded on knots everything that could be counted, even mentioning battles and fights. All the embassies had come to visit the Incas, and all the speeches and arguments they had uttered. True, he was prone to ambiguity and contradictions, as all bloody people are. But a third of the quipus in the collection seem to have a more elaborate construction than others. I've missed out what the collection is. As they contain a different sort of information. For decades, the print was warranted, however, because no one could read them, any of them. The first hints of revelations of quipus came in the 1920s when anthropologist Leonard Locke analysed a bunch of them housed in the American Museum of Natural History in New York, of course. Similar how all the treasures of the world are in Britain and in France. You notice that the knots were organised in rows, almost like beads on an abacus. It demonstrated that each row of knots at a certain height denoted units, tens, hundreds, and so on. Well, there you go. That made sense. Fitting the decimal system with Inca used to divide up groups for two purposes. Now, as the Mayans had a 20s, counted in 20s is beautiful. The discovery sparked a wave of interest. By the 1990s, though, we still had no idea what the numbers meant. You say you read off a number 76, but what does it refer to? To answer that, you would ideally have a translation of a quipu into a familiar language. It would be the equivalent of the Rosetta Stone, which contained the translation of Egyptian hieroglyphs into ancient Greek and unlocked a picture language. In the absence of that, Euron had spent the last 25 years tracking down and carefully digitizing the details of every quipu he could find in the museums and private collections across the world. Today, his quipu database project contains the details of 900 of them. There are all sorts of varying factors in quipus: the colour of the strings, the structure of the knot, the direction in which they're hitched. So, in general, you can have a left and right-handed knot sort of combination. Like in molecules, you can have left and chirality of it. So, it's like left and right-handed. Having spent countless hours pointing over them, Urton began to think that binary differences in the features might be encoding information. Example, a basic knot tied in one direction could mean paid, while in the other direction would mean unpaid. By 2012, he had developed a more specific hypothesis, proposing the direction of the knots were tied, the colours of the strings, or some combination of the two, corresponded to certain stages of the people whose tributes they recorded, and even the individual's names. Without a quipu translation, however, the idea looked like a distant remained untested. Then, in 26, Urton was browsing his personal library when he picked out a book that contained a Spanish census document from 1670s. It was the colonists referred to as the Revista, a reassessment of the six clans living around the village of Recle in the Santa Valley region of western Peru. The document was made in the same region at the same time as a set of 6 kupus in his database. So, in theory, it and the kupus were recording the same thing. Checking it out, Ayrton found that there were 132 tribute players listed in the text and 132 chords in the kupus. The fine details fitted too. The numbers of the chord batch and the chain charges the Spanish documents said to have been levelled. It seems to be matched he was looking for. Isn't that amazing? Okay. Even so, Ayrton was struggling to pick out part of the detail of the connection between the Santa Valley kupus and the Spanish documents. He ended up letting a Harvard undergraduate student's name, Manny Mendro, take a look. Now, people actually do know, or I do know that particular person, because it's written up, but it was written up very much as though he solely did it. There's none of this extra work. He turned out to have the perfect complement of skills for the job. He was a native Spanish speaker and majoring in economics. He was a whiz at spreadsheets. Mendro painstakingly generated tables of the kupu data, combed through them in a search for matching patterns. This year, he and Ayrton showed for the first time that the way the pendant chords are tied into a primary chord indicates the clan's individual belong to. Quote, "It's a really an important achievement," said Jeffrey Spitoza of George Washington University in Washington, D.C., who specialized in kupus from the Wari Empire, which preceded the Incas. Well, this is interesting, that they basically synthesized the existing technology, added a few, but you can imagine that your isolation, this is so true about isolated areas. So the Andes, this civilization didn't have warring people outside. They actually had to have like a Viking blow to them. It's sort of like this insane look. And it's interesting to see how the Vikings influenced the Spanish, quite honestly. But the same idea of conquistadors came across. I don't, my view is that the Spanish, some of the Spanish ideas are sort of Viking, and the barbarians coming across still came across. So had the Roman Empire, there was a whole series of ideas, but the treasure idea is very much a barbarian raiders going across. This is my own view. Okay. So the Wari Empire is before the Inca Empire. It gives a new way to interpret these sources. Gary made things more tractable. Yet, question to of whether the kupus also contained stories still hung there, like that. Strings hung there. Ayrton was not the only one trying to find the meaning beyond the numbers and names. Kupus, Sabine Highland, an ethnographer at St Andrews University in the UK, has spent the past decade searching the central Andes for communities with enduring kupu traditions. She starts, can you imagine? I wonder what she's like. She started by looking for mentions of kupus in the archives before travelling to remote villages in the hope that they might have survived. The strategy tends to be more miss than hit, but in 2015, Highland's persistence paid off, having seen a documentary about her work. A woman, isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful? She's working along pointless, yet a new technology gets the information across, and we would just like to see what goes on happening. Having seen a documentary about her work, a woman in Lima, Peru, got in touch about the kipus in a remote village of San Juan de la Cola, where she grew up. Oh, because Inca Bridge. After months of negotiation with the community, Highland was invited to see 2 kipus. The villagers believe them to be a narrative epistles created by the local chiefs during the rebellion against the French in the late 18th century. The Spanish, sorry. By that time, the people spoke Spanish too, so there are corresponding written words. The kipus were kept locked away in an underground chamber in the village church. Highland and her husband were the first outsiders to lay eye on them, and she was not disappointed. It was an incredible moment, she says. But I didn't have have time to be awestruck, because this was my big chance to study them. I didn't have long. She had 48 hours before the man in charge of the kippus of the village treasurer had to travel to a nearby community festival. Isn't that beautiful? Aww. Under strict supervision, Harlan set about photographing the records, reviewing the manuscripts, taking notes. Each kippu had hundreds of pendant knots, and they were more colourful and complex than anything she'd ever seen. It was clear the various animal fibres used could only be identified by touch. Villagers told the kippus were the language of the animals and insisted that the different fibres had their significance. Her analysis eventually revealed the pendants came from 95 different combinations of colours. Okay, so, 95 is an unusual number. Or fiber type, a direction of ply. Well, even then, you'd have, if you have five, so the problem, my problem is the fact, obviously it's going to be a combination, 95 has to have factors. And so that you've got five and, 5 and 19, just that's just really jarring to my head. That number is so jarring for combinations. Oh, you'd have to have, you wouldn't have this colour with that, there'd be certain blanks. So it's not, things, obviously 95 is the maximum number of things they want to do. That within this range of symbols typically found as the symbolistic writing systems were the set of signs for, say, the letter CAT aligns with the sounds of the word cat. I thought, whoa, oh, this is a bit uncertain, because this is a long time after. I don't understand. Oh, primary chords, substitute chords, pendant chords. Oh, it's very interesting. It's very interesting down here. Wow. Absolutely ripping to look at this. Simeon Harland holds one of the incredible knots. She looks as though she's a well-worn person. She has since hypothesized that the kippus contain a combination of phonetic symbols, i.e. geographic ones, whereas the symbols represents the whole world. Elsie Harland even managed to read a little of the kippus. When deciphering anything, one of the most important steps is to work out what information might be repeated in different places, she says. Because collatures were thought to be letters, they probably encoded the senders and recipients. Whereas that is where Harlan said she knew from the villagers that a primary cord of one of the kippus contained ribbons representing the insignias of one of the two clan leaders. She took a gamble and assumed that the ribbons referred to a person known as Uluka, pronounced Awaka, and also guessed that the writer of the letter may have also signed their name at the end, meaning that the last three pendant cords could well represent the syllables Awaka. Assuming this was true, she looked for cords of the second kippu of the same colour and were tied in the same knot as the ones tentatively identified in the first kippu. It turned out the first two of the three last letters matched, as goes AK. The last was unknown. The golden brown fibre made the hair for an avicana, an alpaca-like animal. Harland realised that the term for this hue in Quechua language was pari, and trying this alongside the syllables gave, with a little wriggle room, Yakapa. That turned out was the name of the other lineage involved in the revolt of the kippus recorded. Quote, that's a bit rich, isn't it? It's a bit uncertain. I wouldn't write that up. We know from the written testimony that one of the kippus was made when a member of Yakapa clan was sent to Kolta, and we think this is it, he says. Harland claims that the Kolta kippus show that the cords really do hold narratives. Even if she's right, it is possible these letter kippus were influenced by context of Spanish writing. My feeling is that the phoneticization, if it's there, is a reinvention of kippus, says Urn equally, Sir Urton. Equally, the Kota kippus might be a regional variation, possibly even a one-off. Of course, that could be. Highlander is first to admit that we don't understand the link between these quipus and those dating from before the Spanish arrived. That doesn't make them any less interesting, though. Okay, well, it does to me. Even if these later quipus were influenced by the alphabet, I still think it's mind-blowing that these people developed a tactile system of writing, she says. She will spend the next 2 years doing more field work in Peru, attempting to decipher the Colata quipus and looking for a similar examples elsewhere. Ayrton, too, is running his attention to narrative quipus, even if he has a different idea on how they encoded information. He suspects they were semasographic, a system of symbols that convey information without being tied to a single language. In other words, they would be akin to road signs where we know all what the symbols mean without having to sound anything out. That makes sense, given the Incas ran a multi-ethnic, multilingual empire, says Ayrton. I would definitely say so. I would definitely say so. It would mean that you're... I cannot think of a phonetic system operating around 5,000 kilometres. Now, there is no solid evidence that any Spaniard living at the time learned to read and make quipu. And that suggests that that they were more complicated than conventional writing, or perhaps just conceptually very different. Quote, this is writing system had an inherently three-dimensional dependent on touch, as well as sight, said Highland. It represents us a uniquely tangled mystery. Oh, do you like that one? It also gives us an important insight. If the Incas used quipus in this way, it might tell us something about their worldview. With a writing system dependent on touch, says Highland, you must have different ways of being in the world. Which is sort of my sense. I think we seem to be continuously surprised by this all corruption being invented around us. I don't know. I look from the Australian perspective, Donald Trump's a very corrupt person, and the whole thing there is corrupt. But I think the invention of corruption is pretty amazing how it's going through. Okay, Leopard Finder with her life on the line. This is a new article. Pira Singh spent months in the jungles of North East India looking for rare felines that caught more than she bargained for with her camera traps. By Adam Popescu, she's probably caught gorillas, but military poachers and okay. Working in the bamboo forests of Mizoram in northeast India isn't easy. Alongside torrential monsoons and poachers, there are armed separatist groups to contend with. Yet, independent wildlife biologist Pira Singh, currently founded by UK conservation charity Rufford Foundation, spent months at a time here to deploy and maintain 160 camera tracks in an effort to spot the country's most elusive cats. Her persistence paid off. She produced the first ever estimate of the marbled cat population. Well, there you go. I didn't know about marbled cats population in the continental Asia and discovered one of the highest recorded densities of clouded leopard. Oh, okay, marbled will be anything to do with spots, I suppose. Her three-year study, published last October with zoologist David McDonald at the University of Oxford, involved combining the thick jungle, combing the thick jungle of Damper Tiger Reserve, which borders Bangladesh and Myanmar. Oh my god. It's a protected park, on paper at least, but Damper is a tiger refuge where she found scant evidence of tigers. Saga's results suggest that the lack of bigger cats has allowed both marble cats and cloud leopards to spend more time. Oh, okay, well, there's one advantage. You'd hate the tigers. You don't have much of a chance. They all got killed off by the Chinese on the ground and grow in numbers. Her estimates put both populations about 5 individuals per 100 square kilometres. So that's a reasonable amount. 100 square kilometres isn't that much, mate. So that's 10 kilometres by 10 kilometres. So that's fair number. Gunmen regularly traversed the forest. While Singh was there in 2015, One-armed group kidnapped 22 local people who were building a road in the park. A little hostage until ransom was reportedly paid. Among images of cats, Singh's camera spotted many gunmen, and the cameras themselves were routinely stolen. India's border security convention, which you go up to the local pub, Rohingya pub, and say, "Hey, mate, here's a VCR, here's a cat camera." Cats want to photograph. India's border security force, the border security, and forest guards patrol here, but are often unpaid for months, not to mention outgunned. Oh, God. That's a job, isn't it? Despite the dangers, for many nights, Singh slept on the forest floor or in caves, unarmed and escorted by several young forest guards. Ooh. Dampers' instability had, in a sense, guarded the cats, keeping outsiders out. Though Singh says the pressure on them now comes from the people living in the area. Globally, the clouded leopard is classified as vulnerable. According to INQ Red List, 100 cats per... That's a fair number. How many cats per... 500 per 100 square kilometres. 500. Let's just redo that. That's population of 5 individuals. Oh, good. I said 5 individuals. That's reasonable. Globally, the clouded leopard is classified, despite her high estimate of numbers of these animals in northeast India, Singh believes her work to raise awareness of the clouded leopard has prompted the Indian government to declare it a critically endangered species, one of the 21 animals in India thought to be on the brink of extinction. Go India. And here's the interview. It's a very short interview. And this is the interviewee says, "What is it like working in the field in such a dangerous environment?" A very inspired person. "For those who enjoy being outdoors, being in the field is the best part of our jobs. Waking up at dawn to the chorus of birds and the excitement of sighting animals all day and being constantly challenged by the diversity of life is an incredible experience. Working in areas where armed groups operate means you must be vigilant at all times. When one spends months living like this, the reality of dangers become clear. Snakes, elephants were the least of our worries." Not snake elephant, but snakes and elephants. "Sometimes it's a challenge to explain your motives for being in such a region. I have had bureaucrats digging for my ulterior motive for working in a challenging landscape, saying, for the love of it, doesn't qualify as a satisfactory answer in such times. What's the scariest thing that happened while you were in the field?" It feels like a kids program asking here. "The last kidney happened while I was working there. Multiple tribes merged in this landscape, which is also along the border with Bangladesh. Many of the elements responsible for kidnapping are still around, but I want to continue working in the landscape to make a difference on the ground in terms of increasing patrolling activities, ensuring the local communities have employment or opportunities so they don't have to operate the way they do right now." How are the local communities living? Well, people in the region tend to be nomadic in nature. They don't have a political security. I'm trying to focus on the wildlife park, but I'm hoping we will be able to find other people to help improve the lives of the local communities. It's very hard for me to tell someone not to go into the forest and kill an animal. They would. Don't go into the forest. Don't kill an animal. People say, if we cannot kill animals, how are we going to feed our children? Go up to the local supermarket. Get a job. We can't afford to buy vegetables and meat for the market. We don't have any jobs. We don't have any money. It's a difficult situation to be in. As a scientist, what keeps you in this area? To come across a patch of forest like this, so rich in biodiversity, is unusual. Someone has to see what such an unstable areas hold. Deforestation may not be be that high here, but the flip side is there's little monitoring or patrolling. The species could be suffering. For example, I didn't find any tigers or leopards, only clouded leopards in my camera traps, and just one elephant. It looks like something has selectively been happening to these large animals, and some people are hunting to support their family. And we'd have to work to help people in these landscapes coexist peacefully with wildlife to see biodiversity benefit for them. It's important to me species are protected from the landscape will eventually be known as the cloud leopard, not for its instability. What attracted you to do this line of work? I grew up on a farm in a semi-arid part of northwest India, spending much of my time interacting with animals, some wild, mostly domesticated. When I was 5, a relative visited who was collecting data for his doctoral study on the wolf. He's now a well-known scientist in the Wildlife Institute in India. He allowed me to accompany him into the field. I want to do what he did. How did you pick animals to study, as it's easier to research, and is it easy to research on a charismatic species? It is true that it's easy to find funding and collaborators interested in cats and tropical forests, but my first study on the striped hyena was dedicated entirely by true interest. No practical considerations. In conversations with my father, I realised hyenas used to occur in areas around our home, but had disappeared. They were never persecuted, but no one seemed to care about their disappearance either. I chose to study them. After 6 months of backbreaking fieldwork, I realised that the research requires being practical. Working on octagonal territorial species in human-dominated landscapes using camera traps that are easily stolen means limited daylight. That was a problem. Working on forest-dependent cats in northeast India is no easier. The landscape throws up challenges of all fronts, climatic, geographical, political and social. I really want to say, well, what's your story? Why are your hyenas gone? Poor India. What's the biggest misconception about your work? Not just cut to the chase. Don't tell us the small. Tell us the biggest one. We are almost always mistaken for being wildlife photographers on TV show hosts of National Geographic, Discovery and Animal Planet. I've never been able to successfully explain to a layperson what work I do and how it will benefit society. Humans always look for factors that will help their own lives improve, not those of other species. And so, you know what? I think that's a cultural thing. Sorry to... Gee, I must be changing. Okay. Natural born metals. This is the next article, and this is by Liz Kalatha. We have discovered the life secret recipe for making materials that are both strong and tough, says Liz Kalatha. Strong and tough. So I suppose, tough would possibly mean fracture proof, so you can have a diamond which is very strong but shatters, and this is really interesting toughness. Who's afraid of a peacock mantis shrimp, brightly coloured, googly eyed, a provision of weird legs, and it doesn't seem much of a threat? But if it's ordinary carpets, however, it looks a remarkable weapon. When the mantis shrimp is aroused, its gob-like appendages punch forward with acceleration greater than a Formula One car engine moving fast enough to make bubbles in the surrounding water, which create a force that shatters the aquarium glass. I think it creates a vacuum, and the imploding bubble then creates it. So, that's my view. That's my understanding of how it goes. So, it also tells you that it's there to get out of aquariums, doesn't it? But I think it's there to kill things. This is an extraordinary feat, especially when you consider the shrimp's deadly appendages are made of nothing more remarkable than the materials in our bone or teeth. It's not so isolated example. Across all the natural world, plants and animals have developed ways of using nature's simple building blocks to astonishing ends. That is, working on the fatigue strength, I would say. Using only meager items on the menu of raw materials, proteins, sugars, without any industrial machinery that we have at our disposal, they have produced structures that can rival anything we have engineered. It's a feat we would dearly like to imitate. The trick lies in the way these constituent parts are arranged on a nanoscale formation that has until recently been impossible to replicate. In general, it's sort of strain relief. I'm making the nano rather than a linear change of materials. It's a gradient thing of materials. Okay. So manufacturing techniques and palette of raw materials improves. Some material scientists have started looking to outdo the natural world. They're using nature's trick to re-engineer materials that form the backbone of our world metals. Surely
they'll go into metamaterials, you know, better structures. A metal's defining qualities, strength and toughness, seem like very different ways of expressing the same thing. But to material scientists, they are like chalk and cheese. Which is actually rather good, because chalk is strong and cheese is pliable, unless, you know, you could step on cheese without breaking a chalk. Okay. Comparison. Chalk is stronger than cheese, but able to resist the load without bending, but not as tough. It's brittle, snapping easily. Cheese may be weaker, but its ability to form before it breaks makes it tough. Metals are generally stronger and tougher than either chalk or cheese, but they are cursed with a weakness. Any attempt to increase the metal's natural strength destroys its toughness. We'd love to change that, but it hasn't stopped us using them for thousands of years. Quote. Yeah, I'll pay that. The world is still made of steel, said Robert Ritchie, the University of California, Berkeley, but stronger is always better. If you have a higher strength, you don't have to use as much material, says Ritchie. That means your planes, drones, or cars can weigh less, saving money as well as fuel and cutting carbon dioxide emissions by warming the planet. Okay, tick is a mini box. Tick, 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 tick. We improved metals could also help light hip replacements, bionic hands, robots, pipelines, reinforcing bars of concrete and coating to protect spacecraft from impact. Ooh, hate that type of stuff. It's trying to tick as many things as possible. Over the past 20 years or so, our control over the nanoscale has improved. We have thought to boost the strength of materials by making the constituents granular smaller. I was going to say the eggs, an eggshell is an example that they're doing the nanoscale of the inside of eggs to see how it's achieved both of that. It's quite interesting. These nanogram metals are super strong, but so brittle that we can't use them in structures. Oh no, that's a bit confusing. If you make the Golden Bridge out of high-strength material, you would need to use such thick girders, but one day it would just snap and break, so Richie. Nature's managed to sidestep the problem. Biological materials are generally made of a mixture of hard biomaterial like calcium carbonate, isn't it calcium phosphate, mate, in your teeth, or silicon, or soft biopolymers such as protein chains or sugar. The hard part provides the strength, and the soft part, the toughness. Together, they're often more the sum of the parts. It's more that the fractures can't propagate, isn't it, the major thing? Like the mantis shrimp club, beneath a thin, hard coating of calcium phosphate, like our bones, it consists of layers of softer fiber-like sugar molecules embedded in yet more calcium phosphate. This composite structure already makes for a better combination of strength and toughness than either material could achieve alone. But what really gives the club the ability to withstand repeated pummeling is the way those layers change as they go deeper beneath the surface. I think they're going to do the gradient structure. The further inside the club we go, the less crystalline the calcium phosphate becomes. See, they took calcium phosphate. Why did they say that? Calcium carbonate. Bloody hell, calcium carbonate's rubbish. Okay, becomes. The layers of aligned sugar molecules also become thinner, and each is rotated relative to the other layer above the layer, forcing any would-be crack to follow a complicated path. This gradient is the nature's secret sauce, as it's almost in every dish. It's probably more difficult to think of structures in the natural world that do not have gradients, like ERG suggests in Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, which is rather good, because you start off growing, as you get bigger, you grow bigger. You start off small, and then you just put in an accelerator. It's like this hormone background feedback mechanism. Gradients come in varieties of flavors. The remarkable flexibility of bamboo stalks, for example, arises from the distribution gradient, with more cellulose fibers found outside the stems to ensure they don't break. The bony plates that protect alligators have gradients in the structural arrangement, with four different types of bone varying in the way collagen fibers align, creating a hard upper surface, a porous core, and a softer base. Fish scales are also made of collagen, having gradient in composition. They are more mineralized at the surface, where the hardness is needed to defend against the teeth of bigger fish, and less so beneath, providing toughness. Even our own teeth have a gradient between two different materials, dentin and enamel. So what does dentin? So I've got to put dentin in the brain thing, creating. So enamel's the calcium phosphate. Dentin is the other spongy stuff. There's a dentin where the holes get through to. So you didn't demineralize it. Smooth interface rather than a sudden change that concentrates stress and initiate breakage. Quote, nature has to play these games because it's not dealing with a particularly good materials, collagen and chitin and minerals, says Ritchie. We'd never use them in our structural materials, but nature has the ability to craft them into ingenious structures. The main thing is that they're biologically laid down. Testing our metal. It's taken a while, but we're just starting to master the same ability. Back in 2011, Ki Lu of Xiyang National University of Material Science in China and his colleagues made a granite structure in copper, one with nanoscale grains at the surface. They gradually increased size to the bulk of the material. As they did this by... with low refractive index things, that we put a nanoscale on things, we can make unreflective glass by getting a gradient index interface with glass. This was a breakthrough, says Ramphans and Theravar from the University of Wisconsin Medicine. Quote, it showed a pathway to improve both the strength and toughness of metals that are often found to be mutually exclusive. Ritchie has taken the concept of gradient nanograins a step further. So there is this nanograin surface for putting surfaces on glass. See, which I just bloody well remember all these types of craps of things. He was inspired by BISIS, a material that in the threads produced by muscles to help them cling to rocky surfaces. BISIS is so strong and tough, and also has a huge gradient, or a gentle gradient. While the rock-facing end is strong and stiff, the muscle end is stretchier and 10 times less stiff. Create this dynamic difference, the form of collagen making up the threads changes along the length. But there is a snag. To replicate the remarkable properties of BISIS, Ritchie needs something which is more complicated than copper. That is because the outer coating of the fiber consists of hard layer and contains even harder granules. A structure is impossible to reduce in pure metal. Instead, Ritchie focused on steel, and alloy of iron, carbon, and other elements. As Lu had done before, he battered the surface of the metal, this time with hundreds of small steel balls, as well as creating a gradient grain size. Oh yeah, that would be solid surface bashing. It also made some pockets of steel shift their structure into a hard phase known as masonite. The result of alternating strokes of hard masonite and softer phase austenite inside each grain, a gradient size paired with two phase structure. What you have to also say, the samurai saws are what I would say is the way you go. Samurai swords are one thing. This combination gives the steel a higher strength than other steels while stopping it from becoming brittle. The hard and soft phases help you, the strength, structural ability, and the gradient gives you a harder, stronger outer surface and a tougher underbelly. Well, this is an interesting thing because a lot of these steels, the crystal thing will move over, after forging, it will move dramatically over the next year. So this is often when you're machining up parts, and like I know people, instrument makers, they will have bits of steel just out in the open in the yard. They've found that steel that they store inside isn't as good as steel that they really regret. It's got to have a good layer of rust on it. Just the sun heating up and cooling down, just in the weather they found. Steel is much better for producing instruments. But so they machine something out of something, it's just out of a foundry, it shifts and moves. I've had that with copper electrodes or brass. Especially you get this problem with shifts and alloys. So rather they can make something, it's put in a little lab, it can easily change and move. I've had metals, like it's called metals heavy metals, it's memory metals, the most extreme example of it. Okay. It's a start, but it only scratches the surface, quite literally, for a theremin, the key for making a perfect metal eyes, enriching deep into the material. In 2016, he fired micro cubes of silver at a rigid silicon surface faster than the speed of sound. The microtubes hit the silicon so hard that they deformed. Causing changes in the grain size he was looking to create. The shock process you will propagate through the material, says Thurman, you're likely to get a continuous gradient. That could be one advantage. Well, this is what a blacksmith does. A blacksmith can do it. For all these laboratory successes, scaling up such a process is a challenge. Quote, one of the problems with emulating nature is nature does it from the bottom up. It takes the atoms of the molecules and builds up from there. This is which we go the other way. We take a big chunk of metal and try to generate it down. The solution might be the merging, of 3D printing, which allows you to build a material layer by layer, which makes small-scale construction possible, says Ritchie, although making large products is more challenging. The problem with 3D printing, despite all the hype here is present, is good for making the right shape, but it's very difficult to make the right properties. He says Ritchie thinks it needs another decade or so to improve. He said gradient narrow-grained steels could be seen in structures in just 5 years, of course, and other super materials could perhaps be available even sooner for Formula One cars or biomedical uses. Even then, nature still will still be able to do the things we can't. The peacock mantis shrimp molts and grows a new shell every 3 or 4 months, removing all the damage done from its club from tens of thousands of insects. That ability packs quite a bit of punch.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.